Hello, this is Dr. Jennifer Christian, Chair of the Praxis Partners Consortium. You are listening to a recording of a one-hour Praxis Partners Showcase session held on March 26, 2014. It features a panel of experts from several disciplines, all of them Praxis members. This showcase is entitled Improve Your Outcomes with the BPSI Model, Introducing the Praxis Partners Consortium. BPSI is an acronym, BPSE, and stands for the Biopsychosocioeconomic Model of Sickness and Disability, to which all Praxis members adhere. You will hear the panelists say why they decided to adopt the BPSI model and tell some brief stories about specific cases that will bring the model to life for you. Notice how each panelist mentions different facets of the model. You can find the PowerPoint presentation used in the showcase and other information about the panelists on our public website at www.webility.md/praxis. That's P-R-A-X-I-S. I hope you enjoy listening to this event.
Okay, so I'd like to kick us off here. Welcome to the first ever Praxis Partners Consortium Showcase. And our topic today is how you can improve outcomes with a BPSI model, introducing the Praxis Partners Consortium. I'm Dr. Jennifer Christian, Chair and Executive Director of this new group. And in case you are on the screen but aren't able to hear, here's the conference call information. And if for some reason you are not able to join us visually, if you go to the website www.webility.md/praxis/showcase, you can get information about the session, the biographies of the panelists, and the feedback form. This session is being recorded and will be available for later playback. As I said, this is the first ever Praxis Showcase. Our intentions are to give you a common sense introduction to the biopsychosocioeconomic model of sickness and disability, to get below the jargon to what is really true on the ground, and to give you some practical examples of how these ideas can help improve medical, functional, and claim outcomes. And one of our goals is to attract new members to our consortium, an action-oriented community of mutual trust and respect with shared values that's out to move the healthcare workers' compensation and disability systems forward at the grassroots level to improve human and financial outcomes. And within our community, we collaborate on projects and do business with one another, so we all thrive. I want to introduce our panelists today. Dr. Chris Brigham is a thought leader and occupational physician by training. He does a lot of work on the legal side of workers' compensation and disability. He's very active with the AMA guides and permanent impairment evaluation, but he's passionate about creating change that will empower individuals to live productive lives and reduce human and financial costs associated with disabling. Our second panelist is Michael Copeland, who's a certified and registered psychologist and a rehabilitation professional. He runs a network of psychologists that deliver cognitive behavioral therapy for people who are having trouble recovering from medical conditions. Susan Eisenhagen, physical therapist, who's a consultant to medical providers and employers. She was a pioneer in functional capacity evaluation and has continued to innovate in job function matching and facilitating a documented evaluation of people's ability to work in, as an aid to return to work. Dr. Les Curte is another psychologist who's just kind of graduating from disability benefits insurance environment and now coming out to do into the world of consulting in order to bring that knowledge that he's gained to other parties and also to go back to working with individuals who have a chance of achieving a better functional recovery. Dr. Fred Luskin is another psychologist on our panel today. He is a senior consultant in health promotion and the director of the Stanford Forgiveness Projects. He's done a lot of work on conflict resolution and helping resolve anger and resentment that stands in the way of wellness and recovery. Dr. Len Matheson is our other panelist from the psychological disciplines, who has come to it more from the rehabilitation end. And he has a deep background in assessment and in innovation in assessment methods and in services to people with disabilities, helping them return to work and take care of their families. And Robin Nagel began life as a vocational rehabilitation consultant and now is a certified disability management specialist and has long experience as a mediator in helping the parties work out solutions. And as I said, I'm Jennifer Christian. I am the chair of this consortium, and I've spent a lot of the last 15 years creating groups and bringing people together with a shared vision to try and improve the system. I am excited about this chance to introduce our new group to you. So the questions we hope to cover today and where I'd like to start is, why did these panelists adopt the BIPSI model? And I think I'd like to start, if you wouldn't mind, Susan Eisenhagen, why did you adopt the BIPSI model? And what do you see as its essence?
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. I started as a physical therapist in the rehab background. So I started in a team approach with psychologists, with physicians, with vocational counselors, and the speech, OT, and psych. So we worked as a group, and I think one of the essences of biopsychosocial is that you really are part of a group and you can lean on each other, but everybody leans on you. The other thing that I found that differs from regular practice is we start with a specific goal so that you want the person to get toward independence, and in this case it would be return to work, but that goal is shared by everybody, including the patient who is part of the team. And I think that's the other one. The patient is involved with everybody, and they're the center of everybody's attention. We're not doing things to them. We're getting them to do things for themselves. I think the last part that I think is an essence is that we come to an outcome, and that allows us to know that we did good, but allows us as a team approach to go forward.
Okay, those are very good points. So, Les Curte, what is your... Why did you decide to adopt the biopsychosocial economic, let's call it the BIPSI model here? What do you see as its essence?
I think the essence is really that we are that we're a functional unit inside of a social fabric, and that's what drives functionality.
Excuse me,
people.
Who's the we there? We're a unit inside a social fabric. Who's the
all,
we?
All of us. Everyone. So,
a human being.
So
okay.
I am as a provider or as a reviewer of a file. The claimant is in that same place. So as a psychologist, it's kind of a natural fit. I part of me wants to say, well, how could I not adopt the BIPSI model? But the main point for me is that we have to understand people inside of the fabric in which they're operating, because that's what's driving functional loss or functional ability, and intervening in that is the way to make it better.
Okay, thank you. And Chris Brigham, why did you adopt the BIPSI model as a physician, and what do you see as its essence?
Jennifer, as a physician trained in the medical model, I was perplexed why some people with marked impairments, such as loss of limbs, would not perceive themselves as disabled. They'd see themselves as challenged, and they were inspirational. And then others would have no objective evidence of impairment, yet portray themselves as disabled, including not being able to work. What I learned is that the medical model that focused on labeling, giving drugs, and doing procedures often does not work. I also learned that we have systems and processes that drive certain behaviors that often adversely impact patients. Much of this relates to money and influences by certain stakeholders, including healthcare providers, attorneys, and others. Many of the issues relate to core societal values. The essence of the biopsychosocial economic model for me is focusing on the health of the body, the mind, and spirit, and function, not injury and disease. And for me, it means involving and empowering our patients and providing them with the tools to be responsible for their health, well-being, and lives.
Okay. All right. That's a nice articulation. And Michael Copeland, I guess, why did you adopt the biopsychosocial model as a psychologist, and what do you see as its essence?
I think in psychology, we're trained in a biopsychosocial model, and in Canada, where I'm from, it's very strongly a biopsychosocial model. So I was trained in that model in the 70s, and then entering into occupational medicine, where Chris Brigham is coming from, I was the person who would be brought in when a person was failing the biomedical model. So that's really what I did. I adopted it, and then I actually became, you know, part of the extended family of it.
Okay. One question I want to make sure we ask the psychologists during this session is, are all psychologists in the biopsychosocial model? So let's remember to put that in, because at least in my experience, they're not all actually in the biopsychosocial model. Some of them are just in the psycho model. But let's go on and ask Robin Nagel, why did you adopt the biopsychosocial model, Robin, and what do you see as its essence?
Well, I would say that I began from the standpoint of the biopsychosocial and economic model in my early training, undergraduate and graduate, and it wasn't until I encountered practice that flew in the face of that model that I was startled into a recognition that I would have to assert that model to correct what was plainly factionalized and fractured and isolated experience of many well-intended professionals in their respective disciplines, not attuned at all to each other and focused on meeting their separate goals. So this was 30 years ago in the beginning of my practice as a rehabilitation counselor. I furthered that effort when I undertook about 20 years ago very intensive training in mediation, in civil organizational and commercial mediation, and in family mediation, and then in arbitration as well, so I could understand a different model for approaching problem solving. That brought me back to my early training and experience, and I realized this was an opportunity to step outside of the prevailing practices and introduce a way for people to come together and talk as peers, as equals in the face of a big problem that needed help, that they would be empowered to help themselves and help each other solve that problem. And
okay.
I succeeded in that.
If I were going to paraphrase, it sounds like your idea of the essence of it is bringing people together to solve the problem. Is that fair?
Bringing people together to recognize their capacity, their inherent capacity to solve their problem. Yes.
Okay. How about you, Len Matheson? Why did you adopt the biopsychosocial model, and what do you see as its essence?
Well, I've always been struck by how important proper motivation is. And so many people get into the early stages of disability with a strong desire to get back to work, but somehow lose it. I think we can do a lot to avoid chronic problems, and even after somebody's become chronic, can help them get out of that by focusing on motivation and keeping that in the forefront. Really working with the person to get clear about what they want to do, and then make that clear to people around them, including all of the treaters, so that all of us can buy into and support the person making appropriate progress.
Okay, and as the late Ken Mitchell said, people always have a motivation. The question is, what is the motivation for?
Right.
And so part of what we're talking about here is understanding why people see the world the way they do now, all the factors that are making them see it and have the intentions they have, and maybe be able to help them change their intentions if we're intervening. How about you, Fred Luskin? What made you decide to adopt the biopsychosocial model, and what do you see as its essence?
You know, the question is even a silly one for me, because it never made any sense whatsoever that the mind and body were distinct. And so any model that doesn't include attention to emotions, personality, thoughts, religious values, community, as well as like pathology or physical, you know, progress of a disease, seemed to me just missing the mark. So I spent my formative years working at Stanford's Center on Integrative Medicine and, you know, learned a lot about the mind-body link and about the mind-spirit link and how they have reciprocal feedback loops which influence each other. So I don't know that there really is any other model that makes any sense.
Okay, that's an argument that there's no other model that makes any sense, but there's sure another prevailing model in the healthcare and workers' compensation and disability systems right now, which is this biomedical model or a social model or a strictly economic model. So I think one question we want to ask is why should the world shift to this model that we're proposing rather than these other models, which happen to be more prevalent at this point? Anybody want to take that question? Why should we shift other than that it makes sense to us?
The current model is not working very well.
Yeah. Jennifer, this is Susan. I just would say that the amount of dollars in disability that are being suffered by anyone paying for disability or suffering disability is huge. And the reason to do a better model, of course, is to get better outcomes. So everybody complains about the problems, and this is a way we could have a solution.
Anybody else have any ideas about
I'd just like to add, with respect to the economics of the issue, we've done a lot of heavy lifting over the last 15 years, and across many industries and sectors, we've become pretty good at collecting and analyzing and interpreting data. The issue is not, is it true that we're fragmented and we're spending billions of dollars and ruining hundreds of thousands of lives, but what do we do about it? I think we need to come to terms with the fact that when many of us began our careers, we were kind of working our way through a lot of unfamiliar territory. But we know it now, and we need to shift gears and begin applying what we've learned to changing the way we do business and work and interactions with people whose lives are at stake.
Okay. And Chris Brigham, did you have something you wanted to contribute?
Yes. My perception experience is that the vast majority of people who've been identified or perceive that they are disabled are not, and they lose the opportunity to experience a joyful and productive life, and that occurs as a result of us having a flawed model. And so using the BPSI model, I see that we can change that.
Okay. So I'd like to ask Len Matheson to tell us a story that he was telling us during the rehearsal that gives an example, like a practical example of what the biopsychosocial model looked like in operation in practical terms. Can you tell us that story, Len?
Sure. This is about Jose, a 29-year-old delivery truck driver with low back pain and radiation, off work for 3 or 4 weeks and sent to physical therapy, monolingual Spanish-speaking, in a physical therapy program down in San Diego working with PTs and athletic trainers. The program used a depression screening questionnaire, a short questionnaire that Jose filled out. And given the score that he had, there was a protocol in place that had the person running the clinic to give me a call and talk with me about what should be done. I provided some guidance to this professional who's a chiropractor, and the chiropractor went through a formal goal-setting process with Jose and identified 12 prioritized goals that Jose had that were his personal goals. The goals included two or three that involved taking care of his family and one that involved trusting God again. He was asking a question, why did God let this happen to me? I'm a faithful Catholic boy. So the goal list was distributed to the physical therapist, the athletic trainer, and what happened was that it became the context of learning to negotiate with his symptoms, and he returned to work with pain about 6 weeks later. I think the difference between this and what we would normally do, first, I think we would not normally have a screener device like a depression scale to screen for people who need extra services to be triaged into that. Second, we normally assign goals to people rather than to inquire about what their goals are. And third, we rarely discuss faith with people. And the fact that his 12-item goal list was out there to be discussed in the clinic with his wife was something that really allowed a context that was much healthier and much more promotive of his motivation.
And listening to you, I think I see a couple of things that are also different from the standard way of doing it. One is that the depression screening was being conducted by physical therapists or chiropractors, wasn't it? And that they, and tell me about the operational setup that made this possible, and you know what was unusual about it in terms of operations and fees than the normal way that care was delivered.
We had a grant that provided a little bit of money to do the screening. One of the issues with screening is that if you get scores in a certain range, you've got to do something about it. You can't just ignore the score. And we had a two-level, the grant provided for two levels of consultation, both of which were telephonic, by the way. With me in St. Louis and the program out in San Diego, that was the first level. And if the problem was able to be resolved with our consultation with the local person doing the intervention, in this case a chiropractor, in some cases a PT at the other clinics, then that was fine. But if that didn't resolve the issue, we had a psychiatrist in San Diego on retainer that would be able to be called. And over about 200 people in this project, the psychiatrist needed to get involved one time. So the big concern that some people have about creating a problem of depression just didn't occur. In fact, I think we resolved a lot of the problems with depression by helping the person make progress towards having his goals met.
Okay, so it sounds like if somebody wanted to make this happen in the real world, in the commercial world, they'd have to figure out a way how to get those screeners to the hands of the physical therapy clinics, figure out how to pay somebody to analyze it and to be the telephone support. But they could set up a system like what you're talking about if they decided that they wanted to do it. So what does need to happen to shift to this model? Let's use Len's story and think a little bit more about it. What does using it mean in practical terms for other people? Let's talk about, Susan, you had gave an example yesterday about what it meant in practical terms in your setting.
Yes, this was a chronically injured person that had been through programs of physical therapy, psychology, of course the medical intervention. She had chronic back pain for 2 years, was on disability, had multiple restrictions from physicians, and she entered into a program where there was going to be addressing the pain and also return to work would be the goal. So I must say, to start out, she entered it knowing that she would progress. My goal was from the physical side of it. And so what I saw immediately on the baseline functional testing course, low scores, but that she had a pain focus. She was very demoralized, and she was very fearful. And that just seemed to come from all the medical and other things that she'd absorbed to tell her she was not competent. Well, as we did the functional movements, and I'm working actually on her body now to help her show that she can move, we worked through lifting, pushing, pulling, all the physical work items. And we did it routinely. I worked on the fact that she was safe, that she'd accomplished something, and that because we measured it, she could see that she was improving. And as she sort of was pushed into this restorative model, she began to see, gee, I am improving. I was able to do that. I'm more focused on my function now. I'm more proud of myself than I was before. And as we got through, there was a 6-week intervention. At the end, she had regained a lot of her physical work ability, but the difference was she had taken charge of her own life during that process. She was now the motivator of herself, and it was no longer me. She'd gotten rid of the fear. She was more confident. And then we compared her to her nursing job, which she did not have the ability to handle the physical demands of patient movement. But she was able to take a job. The hospital offered her a patient educator because those physical abilities were present. So she got off disability, went back to work, very proud of herself, and her focus was now on the people she was helping and not on herself.
So that's a very nice story, and I think people might be wondering, well, so what's different about the way it worked because you guys were working within the BPSI model? How would it normally work? How would it have been different?
Yeah, I think today there's so much focus on a body part that in many cases if you bring someone in and consider, well, you're a back patient. Ooh, you're even a failed back patient. The focus is on the back. And in the BPSI model, you've got to focus on the human being. So I had to get Irene involved with herself. I had to focus on her, but she had to focus on herself. So I think we've got to expand, whether it's physical therapy or any profession, we've got to look beyond the part that comes up in the diagnostic codes and look at the whole person. And it's in our ability, we just change the focus.
Now, in this example that you just gave, were there any differences in either the way that services had to be arranged or coordinated or paid for, or were you able to make this shift in the system as it is today?
In that case, we were part of a team, but as we opened our own independent clinic, we sought out other professionals that would have the similar goals. So we worked with physicians or psychologists or disability managers, case managers, and employers were all part of the team. Sometimes we all just build on their own profession, but we knew that we were all still using the same model. And in some cases, the employer actually paid for the services.
So in some ways, what you're saying is this is underscoring part of why Praxis Partners has value, is because if you are looking for partners with a shared value system and who have adopted this model and want to work as a team, it's a fairly efficient way to do it, is to find people that are collecting around, like something like Praxis Partners. So let's just talk very briefly, because it's so easy in workers' compensation and disability to describe why everything is bad. But can somebody take a fling at why the BPSI model is used so rarely today?
I would say it's terribly inconvenient.
This is Michael
Copeland. This is Robin.
Robin, let's let Michael Copeland speak for just a minute, if you can, and then we'll take you.
I think it's
Michael?
Because we have a silo healthcare system. Yes, this is Michael. We've got a silo healthcare system. It either has to be in the biomedical model or in the mental health model. And a big change happened in 2009 where we got a new health psychology code where we as psychologists, especially under the health psychology approach, can treat under the physical diagnosis. Because in the work comp model, just couldn't accept a psychiatric claim on top of a physical claim. So just that mechanistic factor has made a huge difference that we in health psychology can now see these patients. And so that's had a big change in the adoption of it. So part of it, I think, the barrier has been this silo system and the difficulty navigating between the two.
And finding ways to pay for services that make sense. I would like to have you tell your story at your vignette, but you're garbling a little bit, so let's just ask the audience's tolerance in the poor phone connection, because I think, would you tell your story that you shared with us the other day of the BPSI model in action?
Sure, and I'll present a gentleman who was late 40s, about 5 years into a workers' compensation claim, was really identified because of the pharmacy cost of it. So the pharmacy benefit manager had identified him, and it was presented to the treating physician by a pain peer reviewer to refer him to our Cope with Pain program. So at that point, it engaged many people. And the patient was referred by his physician and saw one of our psychologists. I'm going to turn the biopsychosocial model through his treatment progression on its head. First of all, was a social issue that was identified. This gentleman came in on a walker, presenting diagnosis was complex regional pain syndrome of the lower extremity. And very quickly, by the second or so session, the psychologist in our panel had identified that the disability behavior was being reinforced by his guilt that the small business, which was a family business of his wife's, had to declare bankruptcy because of the cost of his claim, it was purported to him. So, as was talked about earlier by Fred, the forgiveness had to come in. So there was a family meeting, the extended family forgave him. By the next two sessions, he was no longer in his walker. He could give up the walker and having to demonstrate disability behavior. We then went into the psycho side of it. He was depressed after years of being in disability behavior, no social activity. So they worked on activity pacing and socialization and mood management, all with cognitive behavioral therapy, no additional medications. Then came the third stage, which was the hard work for patients after years of the brain being in pain and the peripheral nerves in a complex regional pain syndrome, to teach them the techniques that can actually change the brain's performance of this guarding behavior. And he started decreasing his symptoms, started having less inflammatory disease process going to that extremity. And at the end of 12 sessions, had come off his opioid medications, therefore meeting all of his functional goals for recovery in this stage of his disability claim. It was truly remarkable.
Hmm.
No, the alternative would have been to put him in the silo system, and if a clinical psychology or psychiatry referral had been happening, which was the alternative before the biopsychosocial health and behavior approach that we have now, then he likely would have added another diagnosis of a somatoform disorder or chronic pain due to a generalized medical condition. And that does not do patients any favors, in my opinion, to add another diagnosis. We want to normalize it instead.
So I think actually you're just raised a really important part of the BPSI model, which is that there's nothing that implies mental illness because people are having an emotional reaction or developing a set of beliefs or have habits, right? That doesn't mean they're sick. It means they're human beings. And one big advantage of the BPSI model is it lets us start looking at human issues without having to medicalize them. So, Robin, you had a story about human issues and how within this biopsychosocial model you were able to deal with human issues and resolve a situation. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, but first I'd like to say that the themes of each of these stories are becoming clearer and clearer as I listen. I'm sure they are for others as well. These are all human issues, and we are finding our way into the depths of the human issues as a source of solution. So my story is about a couple of gentlemen who'd worked together for a number of years. Mr. Brown had a back injury in an automobile accident unrelated to work many years earlier, had a surgery, had remained under the care of a physician for a number of years who'd given him very clear activity guidance. But his supervisor, the other fellow in the story, was finding it difficult to accommodate him with repeated requests for not driving on curvy roads. They were in a mountainous area. So Mr. Brown, the safety inspector, told me that he needed revisions to his accommodation because his driving was bothering him and he was feeling more pain. And he was beginning to really lose patience with his supervisor, Mr. McGee. He felt that he was wrong. He felt that his supervisor had it in for him. This is what he told me. And his pain was increasing. He was feeling angrier and less confident in his ability to even talk to his supervisor. He was avoiding him. So the supervisor, who I spoke with separately also, had done what he felt was the yeoman's job of trying to accommodate this gentleman according to medical opinion with regard to his activities. He was becoming frustrated by the inspector's indifference that he felt to the efforts that he'd been making, and he just wanted him to back off or seek a transfer or, look, you're close to 60, just wait till you retire. And the doctor of Mr. Brown was beginning to lose patience as well, I must say, didn't want to prescribe more medication, but said, you know, maybe this work is really not right for you. So my role was to create an environment telephonically based on these private conversations I had with these two gentlemen in which I assured them I would manage the conversation, but we were going to talk together. None of us were in the same place when we had this conference call. And their job was to clearly express their needs, what they wanted to see as an outcome, and what they were willing to try. We agreed also that we would not be talking about solving problems in this conversation. So what happened afterward, I spoke with each of them privately again. The inspector said that it made him feel really good to just tell his boss how he felt. And he was surprised to hear Mr. McGee, his supervisor, tell him, look, man, I'm really trying to work with you, and I'm going to keep on trying. He suddenly began, he said, to feel appreciation for his boss. And he realized that his anger was subsiding. He couldn't really explain it, but he was very outspoken about feeling that. And now he really wanted to take the next step. When are we going to solve the problem? When I spoke to the supervisor, he expressed very similarly themed comments and feelings. He was feeling more sympathetic. He felt less cynical and resentful of this man who was asking for his help. And he'd already begun to come up with other ideas, but he was very anxious to, let's get together because I want to run these out for Mr. Brown. So we have another meeting. And in that meeting, spontaneously, each of these men apologized to the other, not for things that they had said, but for feelings they had that were rising up in them to the point that they were afraid they were going to say something that was that they couldn't take back. They each had had that experience. And when they disclosed this together in our second conversation, at that time, they were in the same place in the office, and they burst out laughing, and they kind of puffed each other on the shoulder. I couldn't see it, but I was on the phone with them as this was taking place. So about 30 days later, Mr. Brown, the inspector, was driving his new route with a few modifications, and he felt more confident. But he said, you know, I don't feel so bad, just physically and emotionally and in all respects. I just feel a little easier about everything. And even my wife is feeling relief. We're going for walks together in the evening. It helps me loosen up my back. She really wants to pray about it. And honestly, if it makes her happy, okay, I can do that. So he was feeling kind of a kind of largesse emotionally. Mr. McGee told me, the supervisor, look, Robin, thanks for all of this. This is great. And you just don't have to worry about it anymore. We're going to be okay. He's actually a pretty good inspector, and I'm glad we got over that hurdle. So one of the things that was important that I did express to them, but I just want to make a point of noting to all of you, I called it sacred time. I acknowledged that in the first conversation we had together, we were not in the same place, any of the three of us. They had never met me, and I had never met them, but that we were going to try to make some sacred time and space in which to talk about some really difficult things, and we just see if it worked. And Mr. Brown had the opportunity to report back to his doctor, who was aware of the proceedings and was available to help if needed. Mr. McGee let his higher-ups know that we're working on it, don't worry. And it actually transpired as a special, you know, non-sectarian but special kind of sacred time in which the good came out that allowed these guys to work together and get over emotions that were contributing to physical problems and functional problems.
Okay, so Robin, the way I hear this is that the bottom line was that the way the environment these people were in and their own inexperience with conflict resolution meant that they were afraid to talk to one another, but they actually both, once they were able to get things off their chest, they just really wanted and were able to resolve it without you. Is that right?
Well, my contribution got them to that point, and they took it from there. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was a, and actually what I listening from a physician, right, and listening from people who are thinking about, there was actually no change in his medical condition. There was no change in his restrictions. What the change was a shift, as Len Matheson said, in their motivation.
Yes.
Now they're motivated to solve the problem because the human issues have been addressed. Their common humanity has been established. That's a very cool story. So, but in the few minutes that we have remaining, I'm wondering, does anybody want to give some examples or ideas for first steps that we can take to move in the BPSI direction, even without legislative change or big changes? What are small changes that providers in various disciplines or payers or purchasers or arrangers of services can do? We've heard in these vignettes some of them, but what other things or what do we want to highlight that are first steps?
Jennifer, I can share some from the perspective of the healthcare providers. The working in partnership with our patients and others, having a common goal of achieving joyful and productive lives, focusing on the whole person, the health of the body, mind, spirit, and function, not an injury and disease. The empowerment is important, is to empower patients to be responsible for their health, well-being, and lives. We can do that at the first visit with explaining our intent, spending time to really understand the story and perspective and values of the patient. Realize that that's often a challenge in our current reimbursement systems, but we can do that by using other staff and questionnaires and inventories, being very careful about the labels we assign, assessing the risk and benefit of all interventions that we do. We can focus on function, not pain. We can teach and provide patients with resources that assist in their understanding and achieving health. And we can demonstrate all these steps in terms of the values in our own lives.
Okay, well said. Anybody else?
This is Jennifer,
Len. Excuse me, let me hear. Who is trying to speak right now?
Well, Len.
Len and who?
Les.
Okay, let me have Len first, then Les.
Just briefly.
I would like to say something. This is Fred.
Okay, perfect. I'd love to have you say it. Okay, Len, Les, and Fred.
Yeah, just quickly, go to promise.com, P-R-O-M-I-S. The National Institutes of Health has developed a patient-reported outcome measurement information system. For free, any of us can sign up to the assessment center and download. They call them outcome measures, but that's a really good, well-designed set of questionnaires that can be used to screen for things like anxiety and depression and problem pain.
Screening tools is what you're saying, really.
That's right.
They're screening tools. That's a great tip. Okay, how about you, Les?
Well, for me, I think the biggest thing is taking those, and it's a great segue, taking those outcome measures that we've been developing. I mean, we've been showing that we get results, translating those results into something that a CFO understands in terms of financially, why make the commitment? That's especially important in the disability world because they don't have control over the medical spend, but they understand that if you can demonstrate a financial impact, I think they're more willing to invest. But we often don't speak that language, those of us who provide these services or consult around it. We don't speak that financial language. We need help in that area.
Okay, so in order to make progress in getting the BPSI model, a small change that is doable is for the people who are arguing in favor of changing service models or payment systems need to be able to show why that would make sense to a person who's looking mostly at dollars, right? Is that
correct?
What you just said?
Okay, that's exactly what I'm saying.
How about you, Fred?
Well, I was just going to suggest that at some level we make available or lead people to see the enormous amount of research that supports this kind of model. You know, so much about even worksite prevention and how counseling, shortens disease outcomes and the effect of meditation or anything on health and companionship and mortality. I mean, there is such an abundance of research that shows that there is so much more to physical well-being than just physical processes. That that would be in and of itself helpful.
You know, that is a wonderful contribution, because we've thought about that, that one of the things that Praxis Partners is as a focal point is to start thinking about creating basically a library, a consolidated library or set of links to all the research, because you are absolutely right. And in addition, I want to speak up for the fact that the biopsychosocial model is more than a doctor and a psychologist, because there's also a lot of research on health literacy, on reading ability, educational information, people's willingness and understanding of their role in life, what chronic pain is, what their condition really means, and then there's a whole body of research now on shared medical decision making, that there are, we have to take people in their, as a human being, and look at where are they weak, where are they strong, and why do they have the motivations and behaviors they do, and try and shore up or change the way their capability to manage whatever is going on in their life. And there is a lot of literature around all of that as well. So that's actually, I think if I were going to think, one of the projects for the consortium might be, just as you said, Fred, to put that all together. I wanted, though, to ask you also, Fred, in terms of patient empowerment or strengthening, that you've done some work in the self-help arena. And does anybody, Fred, I'd like to hear from you around people's abilities to use self-help materials, but does anybody else have instructional, educational, or training programs that are part of their, what they see as the biopsychosocial approach?
Well, I would answer that part of this model is empowering people to not have to use medical professionals for everything. And so self-help and education and just simple skills that they can take home with them is foundational for this. So I don't know how we could describe a model like this without some value with self-help. You know, for me, the two simplest things that I have found that are necessary to be addressed in many, many patients in medical offices are, you know, grief and anger, and or grief and loss. And so anger and all the consequences of grief have physical, you know, experiences associated with them. And so I have dealt with people in every form of, you know, experience with the medical profession, legal, educational. I've dealt with people who have had their children murdered and all sorts of stuff. And most of them have physical illnesses that come along with the unmanaged stress from grief, loss, or anger. And if those aren't addressed, I've seen people struggle for 20, 30 years with back pain, with, you know, digestive upsets, with heart disease, with twitching, with almost every conceivable manifestation of unresolved emotionality. And, you know, education goes a long way to normalize it and help people understand that that's a normal aspect of the response to difficulty, and that their body's going to react to it as well, and that it's essential for them to deal with that part of themselves as well as take their blood pressure medication.
Yeah, very well said. You've reminded me, I'd like to recommend to any of the clinicians that are on the phone, there was a very, very good book by a physician named Alan Barbour, B-A-R-B-O-U-R, who was at Stanford University, and the book is called Caring for Patients. And he was one of the, he was an internist, and he really saw how the body basically manifests in symptoms, unresolved life predicaments. And that by failing to help people understand the role of how their body is an integral part of their humanity, and that's a part of this biopsychosocial model too. It isn't just how people are thinking, but it's how they're thinking, believing, and seeing the world and the unresolved conflicts they have that are actually creating physical symptoms. That is a big piece of what we're kind of, most of the world is weak at talking about now. Anybody else have any other ideas about practical first steps?
Yeah.
Michael Copeland, you probably have some comments because you've been getting people to take some of those first steps.
Sure. From an organization point of view, We've been very successful in the United States and Canada with the early intervention. We have more and more large corporations starting the pain screening questionnaire, which gets at catastrophic thinking, guarding behavior, and work attitudes as early to 2 to 3 weeks. A major school district is just starting, and they're going to use the physical therapist's clinics as the screening opportunity at 2 to 3 weeks. So that's one way to get at this early intervention. Other thing is that the NIH funded a project to provide our type of CBT materials at a low literacy level and in Spanish. So we have them at a grade 4 level now, which has made a huge difference in being able to explain in very concrete terms this extremely complex mind-body biopsychosocial relationship. And so those sorts of developments are really exciting as this collaboration has continued in the biopsychosocial approach.
So, Michael, are those low literacy things available to other people? Where can people find them?
They're available with permission for clinical use, and people can contact me for it. I can't take any credit for it. It was done by Beverly Thorne with an NIH, and she's given me use, so I can't given the next level of use, but I can introduce it to who was done at the at a university level.
Okay, that's a great resource. Anybody else have any other ideas on
Jennifer? Yes? This is Sue. Can I put in a comment just to follow his about early intervention?
Sure.
There are a lot of cases where people have a lot of psychological problems, but we make some of these things into psychological problems when they didn't start. And sometimes when people come in with an injury, the current model is that a doctor, a therapist, whoever is going to see them and say, oh, you have a back pain. Oh, you hurt your back. Oh, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you having? And what that does to the person is it puts them right away into a sick mode. They're a back person, and the pain is the most important thing the doctor wants to know, or a therapist can do it. So to keep the person as a person, it's much more helpful, I think, if you go, oh, John, you're here. You had some difficulty at work, and I know that you had difficulty doing some of that lifting at the end of the day, and we're seeing you. And I know that you're a Banbury operator. Tell me a little bit about how your work went. And by that way, you're keeping them as a human being. You're keeping them as a worker. You're still going to address the issue, but you're addressing function and not pain. And I think that goes along with your ACOM guidelines of stay at work, return to work, that if you keep them in a worker mode and you work with the employer so that they stay at work in a good capacity, the people aren't going to develop, at least some of them, they're not going to develop the dependent behaviors, the anger behaviors, the disassociation from the work, the feeling they're really, really sick and they still have pain. So I'm just suggesting, too, that early intervention can forestall some of the problems.
Mm-hmm. Actually, do you think, in listening to you, it's also clear that words are part of the treatment, and that when we speak to people in a way where what we're doing is focusing on their pain or their body part rather than on how their life is going and how can we help you minimize the disruption of your life, we're creating a patient with those words, or we're creating a person. And just the example you told about focusing on pain, we have a program called Maze Masters where we work with people who are terribly lost in the workers' compensation system. And this one guy, Ernest, after just one session with his guide, said, wow, I figured out I can decide what to pay attention to. I've been paying attention to my pain because just exactly what you said, Susan, everywhere I go, everybody asks me my pain level. And I've decided I can shift my attention and focus on something else. And what he was being encouraged to focus on was what kind of a life does he want? What kind of a future does he want? So the power of words as a way of creating futures, of creating reality, and of creating intention is huge. And so we can move into the biopsychosocial model by simply changing our vocabulary and the questions we ask to some degree. I think that's what I'm hearing from everybody at this table.
Jennifer, I have a tiny news tip that I'd like to pass along in the last couple minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The Centers for Disease Control has just initiated a new educational program for employers that is designed to help employers learn the basic principles and apply them in their workplaces of promoting health and productivity in the workplace. And you can find out a little bit more about this at cdc.gov/workathealth. That's the name of their program. And I have the benefit of being accepted for training in a train-the-trainer portion of this program. The very first train-the-trainer session will begin in April, but they're being held throughout the country. So it's just another little indicator that parties and governments, independent people like us, we're aggregating our insights and knowledge toward very concrete, programmatic approaches to delivering on all of these years of, you know, clinical studies, insights, practice, experience, trial and error. I'm hoping that that is going to be something that contributes.
So as we move towards the close here, we found a diagram. There isn't too much sexy material out yet on the biopsychosocial model. The language biopsychosocial economic is so many syllables it's going to probably turn people off. We probably need to think of a cooler title. And we need bright, colorful materials. And this actually comes from a website from Deepak Chopra. But it's really pointing out that what total well-being for a human being is well-being in many domains of life. And the career, the social, the nutritional, physical, financial, and community sectors of life are where wholeness and well-being is arising in all those areas. And by contrast, of course, non-well-being or feeling ill or sick may be due to lack of balance or wellness in any of these domains. And so if we want to help people heal, we need to look at all the domains of their lives and figure out where is it off and what can be done, what's remediable in order to help this person get back to well-being. Because if you have a back problem and your whole being is sick, you are not going to be able to recover from your back problem, which gets us back to Chris Brigham's initial observation. Why do two people with the same anatomical injury or diagnosis end up with such different outcomes? And just in this last 3 months, we got a referral into Mace Masters of a nurse who had a spinal cord injury, was a quadriplegic, and basically her day consisted of lying in bed in a nursing home, addicted to painkillers, and arguing about how many boxes of latex gloves she was allocated each month. And in the same week that we got that referral, I met with one of the new assistant undersecretaries in the U.S. Department of Labor in the Office of Disability Employment Policy, who happens to be quadriplegic herself. So identical biology and totally different outcomes. If we want to help people heal, we have to help heal them in the places where their humanity is at risk. So in closing, I want to could you repeat the URL, the web address, Robin, for that CDC website?
Yes, and first let me say you can just Google Work at Health and it'll take you to that section of the Centers for Disease Control's website. It's a brand new program.
You're saying the word work and the at sign and health, right?
Work and the word at and health. They do abbreviate it to the at sign in mm-hmm. their program materials, but I'm just, you know, the quick and dirty is to just go to Google Work at Health and you'll get there.
Okay, thank you. And then for everybody else, we do hope that you will send in your feedback forms, because since this is our first showcase, we're eager for suggestions for improvement and feedback. And, of course, we are hoping that you are going to take a stand yourselves and try and move whatever way you can into the BPSI model in order to improve outcomes for both people and the financial outcomes as well, and P.S., to have less people on permanent disability roles and leaving the productive workforce of the country. And we would encourage you to learn more about the Praxis Partners Consortium or even apply to join us. And with that, thank you very much, panelists. Thank you very much, everybody. See you next time.